Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Christian Unity Week draws to a close as Pope Benedict celebrates Vespers in the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls. Yet the regular work of ecumenical dialogue continues. We hear from the editor of the Jesuit-run America magazine and from a protagonist in the quest for unity between the Catholic Church and the World Methodist Council. On Wednesday evening, Pope Benedict celebrated Vespers to mark the feast of the conversion of St. Paul and the close of the week of prayer for Christian unity. Gathered with him in the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls were Orthodox Metropolitan Gennadios, representing the Ecumenical Patriarchate, Canon David Richardson, representing the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, plus representatives of the many other different churches and ecclesial communities who've been marking the event focused around the theme, We Shall Be Transformed in the Victory of Our Lord Jesus Christ.
Nella cultura oggi dominante, l'idea di vittoria è spesso associata un successo immediato.
In the dominant culture of today, the Pope said, the idea of victory is often associated with immediate success. For the Christian, however, victory is a long and not always linear process of transformation and growth in goodness. It is achieved according to God's timing, not ours, and requires of us a profound faith and patient endurance.
Uniti in Cristo, siamo chiamati a condividere la sua missione.
All Christians, the Pope said, must act together for the common good, united in Christ and called to share his mission, that is to bring hope to the places where there is injustice, hatred or despair.
L'ingiustizia, l'odio e la disperazione.
Pope Benedict speaking on Wednesday at the close of the week of prayer for Christian unity in the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls. During this week of prayer for Christian unity, the English-speaking churches and religious institutes here in Rome are the focus for many ecumenical initiatives and shared worship services. Among the highlights this year was a prayer liturgy and presentation at the Centro Pro Unione by Jesuit Father Drew Christiansen, editor-in-chief of America magazine, on the promotion of justice and peace in an ecumenical context. During the 1990s, Father Drew headed the U.S. Catholic Bishops' Justice and Peace Office and later continued to advise the Bishops' Conference, especially in the field of support for the Christian churches in the Holy Land. Following his lecture, Father Drew came to Vatican Radio to tell me more about his work and his hopes for the future of the ecumenical movement.
You know, there's a way in which theological discussion and theological dialogue, I won't say it's at a dead end, but it's a kind of a slough right now. And I think for the average Christian, it's all too technical, you know. I think that on the local level, where people experience ecumenism most is in social ecumenism, because they join up with others and in pursuing a particular goal, they coalesce around an issue and then work from there. And then they may have common prayer services and so on, and then begin to get an appreciation for another's faith. But it is where people on the ground come together, I think, and experience a real joy in being Christians and working together for the common good. I think it'd be well if it were really appropriated by people in all the churches and Christian communities as something they're doing precisely as a commitment to social ecumenism. And as I said, I think one of the areas that could well be developed is that groups, mixed groups, could try to discern the signs of the times together. It doesn't mean that there aren't other roles and other responsibilities with discerning the signs of the times on the part of the magisterium and on the part of bishops' conferences and so on. But it seems to me that that's a part of the conciliar experience and the post-conciliar experience that did develop for a time but needs really to be reappropriated.
You worked for a while, didn't you, on the Catholic Mennonite dialogue in particular?
I did.
Can you give us any examples of where perhaps this work together on social issues brought the communities closer together or brought a greater understanding?
We published our report in 2004 on the conclusion of the first round of the International Catholic Mennonite Dialogue. In 2006, the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity brought to Rome a delegation from the World Conference, World Mennonite Conference, and it was, with a couple of exceptions, a different group than engaged in the dialogue. Now, what was astonishing about that meeting was that there was wide agreement by people who hadn't been a part of the earlier dialogue, and maybe because they were active church administrators and in some cases pastors that had on the ground ecumenical experience, discussion went very fast. And I wound up inadvertently, because the Mennonites didn't come up with their own theologian, being a theologian for both sides, and they both were happy with it. But, you know, there was agreement. We put together a statement for the World Council of Churches Decade to Overcome Violence, which was an institutional statement by both sides on things that we could agree on, we hope that the Decade to Overcome Violence would deal with. And the rapid agreement was just astonishing. And what was important there is that the Mennonites don't see themselves as a theologically sophisticated community. Actually, they have many sophisticated theologians, but the notion that the theologians have a less significant role than they would in the Catholic Church. So the people are practical, you know, and they wanted to see some common action. And they said, well, next stage, we got to do something practical. And this wasn't very practical, but it was, you know, nonetheless, an agreement on a practical agenda that we could present to the other churches together as kind of common positions that ought to be worked on.
You've also been particularly involved in the Middle East, haven't you, as an advisor to the American Catholic Bishops Conference. Do you see, in some sense, the failure of any lasting peace agreement there? Do you see that somehow this reflects a failure on the part of the churches or faith communities even to be a more powerful advocate in that region?
Yes, I do. I think we never fail to engage sufficiently the grassroots to advocate on behalf of Christians in the Holy Land. And I think, you know, the formal organizations that are committed to support the church, they're supported financially, but they've not been able to get their act together on the justice and peace advocacy. The Knights of the Holy Sepulchre in the U.S. had for a few years, 3 or 4 years, an office for justice and peace, and it would advise the various lieutenancies about what issues were and what they could do, but it only lasted a short time. The lieutenancies, some lieutenancies never used it at all, and with the change in leadership in lieutenancies, the people felt it was too political, and so their support is financial and social and a union of prayer, but the active organization, the active advocacy is not what it should be. You know, that's a real disappointment. I mean, I worked very hard on that for a number of years, and the U.S. Church became very close both to the Church in the Holy Land, but also to the Holy See. We collaborated very closely. This coordination of bishops' conference meeting you attended last week in Jerusalem was a result of a coordination that the Vatican asked us to put together. I was leaving the job at the bishops' conference towards the end of 97. I left finally in 98. But when I came here to say goodbye, they said, no, you can't leave. You can't leave. You need to stay. And then finally it became, you need to stay in the ring, at least in the Middle East. So I stayed with the Bishops' Conference another 6 years as a counselor and did other things, but primarily continued to advise in the Middle East. I'm still engaged in various ways. But it's very hard to keep purchase. Politically, it's just incredibly tough territory. The U.S. Congress in particular, we call occupied territory. We could always do better whether you had a Republican or Democratic administration. The State Department and the National Security Council usually understood better the issues, and you know, you could get some kind of agreement there. In Congress, you could make very little headway.
That brings me on, in a sense, to my next question. What do you see as the most effective way of Christians for promoting justice and peace today? Is it advocacy, or are the other areas of solidarity and aid and development, where do you see as the most effective key to achieving results today?
I think things need to be in concert. I spoke yesterday about the Catholic Peace Building Network, but I think, and that's a combination of scholars, bishops' conferences, local groups coming together to exchange experience and expertise and work on new projects. But those projects need outside advocacy to support them in different ways as well. And, you know, as we learned in the Middle East, you can't make headway without a change in foreign policy. You know, you need to have people engaged in foreign policy.
And does the church still have a voice there, do you think?
I think it can. You know, my experience was generally the U.S. administrations were willing to assist us in secondary issues and not in primary issues. So, you know, when we'd say, well, you know, the issue of Jerusalem is very important and you need to see that this is kind of kept out of the divvying up of Jerusalem. There are other interests to be taken care of, their access to the Christians, the presence through citizenship and residency permits of Christians in the region and so on. Well, you know, they prefer to deal with a particular issue that they could show political gain on. So at one point you might get when the radical Muslim groups in the equivalent of Muslim Brotherhood in Israel was trying to build a mosque in Nazareth. And President Bush intervened at the request of Cardinal McCarrick quite directly in that. But it took a couple of years and a couple of interventions for the president to the prime minister to get that to happen. And in the end, it wasn't the prime minister, it was the courts that put an end to it in Israel. So you have to get very persistent attention to the issues to see that something can happen. But I'd say I think that the Catholic Peace Building Network, which is based in the United States, is a real worldwide network of Catholics involved in peacemaking. Its bishops themselves have been mediators in situations, as their staff people. It's other independent Catholic groups that are working for peace or reconciliation in one way or another. It's experts in conflict resolution working with them. And I think it's a real model for what can be done. But I don't think they can work in a vacuum. You still need the advocacy as well. And that's kind of what we've tried to do over the past years.
What do you see as the largest challenge to that work today?
I think the real danger is the materialism of Western society, and therefore the lack of a broader commitments and deeper commitments. There are young people who have them and pursue them, and although they do it in a more independent kind of way, I think. But there's a real need to engage the next generation in that kind of commitment. We've done a couple of stories now in America about parents who really tried to bring their children up as Christian, very much involved in their Catholic upbringing. And they write, you know, they maintain their social justice concerns, but they're not committed to the church. So we need to have both. And social justice commitment shouldn't become a substitute for the church. But we need to cultivate that. And more broadly in society, we need to contribute to renewal through encouraging people's deeper aspirations, I think.
My thanks there to Jesuit Father Drew Christiansen, Editor-in-Chief of America Magazine. And you can hear more from Father Drew on our programme this weekend as he looks back at John the 23rd's landmark encyclical Pacem in Terris and the impact it's had on the justice and peace movement over the past half century. Relations between Catholics and Methodists is one of the formal ecumenical dialogues which has made great progress since the Second Vatican Council. A first meeting was held just outside Rome in 1967, and since then a joint commission has reported to its respective churches at 5 yearly intervals. Though the two denominations may still seem a long way off from full church unity, this dialogue has a well-kept secret of excellent bilateral relations and significant growth in shared spirituality and mission.
We get along so much better with the Roman Catholics as Methodists because we never separated from the Catholic Church.
Reverend Dr. Karen Westerfield Tucker is a United Methodist minister and professor at Boston University's School of Theology, with a special interest in liturgical history and hymnals. She's also a member of the national and international dialogues between Methodists and Roman Catholics, hence her visit to Rome recently for the start of a new round of talks between the two churches.
Well, our last 5 years of dialogue dealt with topics related to baptism, Eucharist, and ministry. Not that we were using that very important document that came forth from the World Council of Churches, but that the three areas where we felt we needed to work in our conversation were in specifically those areas of baptism, Eucharist, and ministry. This next dialogue, we hope, will take a topic that's related to it, but we haven't quite figured out exactly what we're going to do yet. We're looking at the areas of prayer and issues related to that, of assurance and justification.
The Methodist dialogue seems to take place quite successfully, quite quietly behind the scenes. It seems to avoid some of the controversies that surround the other dialogues with, for example, the Anglicans or the Lutherans.
Well, one could say Methodists are just naturally agreeable, but I don't think that's the case. Sometimes in our dialogue we say we get along so much better with the Roman Catholics as Methodists because we never separated from the Catholic Church. Unlike Lutherans and Anglicans, where there was the separation, we are somewhat likened to grandchildren, and sometimes grandchildren and their grandparents get along much better than children and parents do. But the dialogue has been going on for more than 40 years now, and we just recently produced a synthesis text, kind of harvesting the fruits document between our two partners. And I'm not sure where that rests right now in terms of reception. It was received with great acclaim by the World Methodist Council and Conference in August of this year in Durban, South Africa. But I'm not sure where it rests right now on the Vatican side.
How much would you say within the Methodist world, how much interest, concern is there about the ecumenical movement?
I think it varies by region. I think in places, particularly in North America, there's still some interest in ecumenical dialogue. In Western Europe, I suspect some of the same. Other parts of the world, it's not so keen. In fact, I know in some places in the Latin South, the conversation between Roman Catholic Church and the World Methodist Council is viewed with a bit of suspicion.
Whereas in the West, it's sometimes talked about as the victim of its own success.
It's very much assumed that this is the way it is. But there's a whole generation of students coming along, at least in my place in Boston, that are really deeply interested in issues of ecumenism and also interfaith conversation.
What do you see, perhaps, as the biggest obstacles on the road to full visible unity?
That's a tough question. I think issues related to ordination are a very big issue. Understandings of sacraments. So one of the things we did in our most recent conversation with the Roman Catholic World Methodist Dialogue was to really start pressing some issues related to sacramental theology, particularly the notion of sacrifice, which for many Protestants has been of great concern. But I think the language that we use has been able to break open some of the obstacles, and we can see some new ways forward. That certainly has happened, for example, at the level of the World Council of Churches related to baptism, in conversations between believer Baptists and infant baptizing communities, that when we look at how we baptize and the theologies around baptism, that we see perhaps more similarities than differences when you really start pressing the issues.
Particular interest, as you say, is liturgy, isn't it? And particularly what you call the cultural dynamics of hymnals. What exactly do you mean by that?
The questions I raised related to hymnology are how do hymnals as collections convey the theology of a particular community or a particular denomination, ecclesial communion? What does the hymnal in its organization and in its construction say about who the church is for that particular cluster of church families? The cultural dimension, I think, is interesting, is how does that then get reflected in the language, the musical forms that get used related to the life of worship? What are people singing and how are they singing it?
Given the role of Wesley within the Methodist world, I presume this is truer about Methodism than perhaps any other denomination, is it?
I don't know if it's truer than any other denomination, but it's extremely important in the Methodist and Wesleyan tradition. For a very long time, we did not have seminaries, but we did have hymns. and the way people were trained as clergy, as pastors, as lay preachers, was to study the collected hymns and the organization of the hymns and the hymnals. So part of my own research has been to look at how hymns are organized in hymnals, not so much which hymn, but how theologically and systematically the hymnals are organized, and what does that say then about the faith of that particular denomination or community. It becomes much more complicated now in the age of the internet, when people are selecting things from various resources and not necessarily using their own denominational hymnals. It gets a bit more confusing. So one of the things I raise is that whole question of ecclesiastical identity when there is no stated sung repertoire.
How does that relate, would you say, within the Catholic Church, where hymns do not play such an important part in the liturgy?
I think one of the questions that gets raised then is, what is the style of singing in general, if they're singing at all? What are the sources for the songs that are used, not just as service music, but as more broadly part of the liturgy? Entrance songs, final songs, songs sung during the distribution of the Eucharist. What kind of music is being sung? Not only the style of music, but what are the words being said? I've been very pleased as a Methodist to see, at least in the United States, Charles Wesley texts appear in the hymnals that are used in Catholic churches there. And one of the great joys I've had is to be able to be a substitute organist in the Catholic parish in the town where I live, which is a bit amusing for the staff to know that there is an ordained Methodist minister sitting in the balcony of the Catholic parish church while Mass is going on.
As you know, within the Catholic Church, really since the Second Vatican Council, there's been, I would say, sometimes a furious debate around the question of liturgy, the reform, and the renewal of the liturgy. Do you see similar concerns within the Methodist world?
I do. In the Methodist world, at least in British Methodism and in North American Methodism, some parts of North American Methodism, we followed along very closely what was going on with the liturgical revisions prior to and after the Second Vatican Council. And many of our own liturgies are modeled very much on what was produced after the Second Vatican Council. But in North America in particular, there have been other streams of interest or influences, one might say, on how worship is done. So with the folk movements, with different kinds of social justice movements, now in the United States, we have liturgy practiced in our churches that very much looks like the structure of the Roman Catholic Mass, but we have other churches that have gone to more of a freestyle, which actually goes back to our heritage as Methodists, but it actually today is drawing more from the folk traditions or more popular charismatic traditions.
As you know, under this Pope, there's been a great desire to perhaps go back to the days before the Council to rediscover, as he would put it, the beauties of the older liturgies.
Yes, I think there is an importance in looking to the tradition, to know who we are, where we have come from. But I also worry, and not only as a Protestant looking at the Catholic new interest in the tradition, but also as a Methodist looking at the past. I'm principally an historian by training, that we don't get so caught up in our past that we forget to look forward, that the Spirit is one that calls us to remember who we are, but the Spirit still moves ahead of us and moves us in new directions. And it's been a little disappointing, I must admit, from the liturgical point of view, to see a bit of backtracking in terms of the ecumenical texts that have been produced. Because, in fact, many of the Protestant churches in the West have borrowed from or imitated the texts that were produced after the Second Vatican Council. So, for example, in North America, we have, among the Mennonite community in the United States and in Canada, an imitation of RCIA. In the United States, the United Methodist Church has had an unofficial equivalent of RCIA. So the documents that have been produced by the Roman Catholic Church have been very influential in Protestant communities, and it has seemed very strange for some of our pastors and some of our congregations to see a moving backward away from the kind of consensus that has been built.
So you would say then that this, if you like, backtracking or looking back to an older form of the liturgy is having a profound influence on the ecumenical movement, a detrimental effect on the ecumenical movement.
Oh, I would say absolutely so. I think there's a great concern about, I don't want to say a breaking of trust, but a sense of how do we stand, where do we stand? You know, we have shared these prayers, we've shared these liturgies, we've shared this tradition. How can we move forward now when some of us are moving backward? And it's not just the Roman Catholic Church that's kind of backtracking. Some of the Protestants are doing it as well. Also more interested in these popular cultural forms, which are taking us, in some cases, in different directions as well.
This is a particular concern to you, I imagine, as head of the Societas Liturgica. Can you tell us a bit about that, what it does?
Actually, I'm the former president. I finished my term in August with our meeting in France, in Reims. Societas Liturgica is an international and ecumenical society of liturgical scholars. We have, I think about 300, 400 members. The society produces a journal called Studia Liturgica, for which I am currently the editor-in-chief. And we're very concerned about disseminating information about liturgical studies across the countries, across the churches, so that we can see what we have in common, what are our differences, where's the research that has yet to be done. So Societas Liturgica gives us an opportunity to share the research that we're doing to address ecclesiastical issues and problems. So our conference in France in August dealt with issues related to baptism. Our Congress in 2013 will be in Germany, and we're looking at the whole issue of liturgical renewal, not only as a celebration of the anniversary of Sacrosanctum Concilium, but also at the kinds of liturgical renewal that is ongoing in many other churches and places where there might need to be more renewal done. Issues related, for example, to rites for marriage, services of healing, and maybe issues of renewal, how churches can together collaborate on renewal in understanding worship in general.
My thanks there to Dr. Karen Westerfield Tucker, professor at Boston University's School of Theology and a member of the International Dialogue between the Roman Catholic Church and the World Methodist Council. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.